Chapter 13. In the complicated old European communities, Archer began to guess love problems might be less simple and less easily classified. Rich and idle and ornamental societies must produce many more such situations, and there might even be one in which a woman naturally sensitive and aloof would yet, from the force of circumstances, from sheer defenselessness and loneliness, be drawn into a tie inexcusable by conventional standards. On reaching home, he wrote a line to the Countess Olenska, asking at what hour of the next day she could receive him, and dispatched it by a messenger boy, who returned presently with a word to the effect that she was going to Skuytercliff the next morning, to stay over Sunday with the van der Luydens, but that he would find her alone that evening after dinner. The note was written on a rather untidy half sheet, without date or address, but her H, and was firm and free. He was amused at the idea of her week ending in the stately solitude of Skuytercliff, but immediately afterward felt that there, of all places, she would most feel the chill of minds rigorously averted from the Gleasant. He was at Mr. Letterblair's punctually at 7, glad of the pretext for excusing himself soon after dinner. He had formed his own opinion from the papers entrusted to him, and did not especially want to go into the matter with his senior partner. Mr. Letterblair was a widower, and they dined alone, copiously and slowly, in a dark shabby room hung with yellowing prints of the death of Chatham and the coronation of Napoleon. On the sideboard, between fluted Sheraton knife cases, stood a decanter of hot Brian, and another of the old Lanning port, the gift of a client, which the wastrel Tom Lanning had sold off a year or two before his mysterious and discreditable death in San Francisco, an incident less publicly humiliating to the family than the sale of the cellar. After a velvety oyster soup came shad and cucumbers, then a young broiled turkey with corn fritters, followed by a canvas bag with currant jelly and a celery mayonnaise. Mr. Letterblair, who lunched on a sandwich and tea, dined deliberately and deeply, and insisted on his guests doing the same. Finally, when the closing rites had been accomplished, the cloth was removed, cigars were lit, and Mr. Letterblair, leaning back in his chair and pushing the port westward, said, spreading his back agreeably to the coal fire behind him, "The whole family are against a divorce, and I think rightly." Archer instantly felt himself on the other side of the argument. "But why, sir? If there ever was a case, well, what's the use? She's here, he's there, the Atlantic's between them. She'll never get back a dollar more of her money than what he's voluntarily returned to her. Their damned heathen marriage settlements take precious good care of that. As things go over there, Olenski's acted generously. He might have turned her out without a penny." The young man knew this and was silent. "I understand, though," Mr. Letterblair continued, "that she attaches no importance to the money. Therefore, as the family say, why not let well enough alone?" Archer had gone to the house an hour earlier in full agreement with Mr. Letterblair's view, but put into words by this selfish, well-fed and supremely indifferent old man, it suddenly became the pharisaic voice of a society wholly absorbed in barricading itself against the unpleasant. "I think that's for her to decide. H'm, have you considered the consequences if she decides for divorce?" "You mean the threat in her husband's letter? What weight would that carry? It's no more than the vague charge of an angry blackguard." "Yes, but it might make some unpleasant talk if he really defends the suit." "Unpleasant," said Archer explosively. Mr. Letterblair looked at him from under inquiring eyebrows, and the young man, aware of the uselessness of trying to explain what was in his mind, bowed acquiescently while his senior continued, "Ivers is always unpleasant. You agree with me?" Mr. Letterblair resumed, after a waiting silence. "Naturally," said Archer. "Well, then, I may count on you, the Mingotts may count on you, to use your influence against the idea?" Archer hesitated. "Can't pledge myself till I've seen the Countess Olenska," he said at length. Mr. Archer, I don't understand you. Do you want to marry into a family with a scandalous divorce suit hanging over it? I don't think that has anything to do with the case. Mr. Letterblair put down his glass of port and fixed on his young partner a cautious and apprehensive gaze. Archer understood that he ran the risk of having his mandate withdrawn, and for some obscure reason he disliked the prospect. Now that the job had been thrust on him, he did not propose to relinquish it, and, to guard against the possibility, he saw that he must reassure the unimaginative old man who was the legal conscience of the Mingotts. You may be sure, sir, that I shan't commit myself till I've reported to you. What I meant was that I'd rather not give an opinion till I've heard what Madame Olenska has to say. Mr. Letterblair nodded approvingly at an excess of caution worthy of the best New York tradition, and the young man, glancing at his watch, pleaded an engagement and took leave. Zia. Old-fashioned New York dined at 7, and the habit of after-dinner calls, though derided in Archer's set, still generally prevailed. As the young man strolled up Fifth Avenue from Waverly Place, the long thoroughfare was deserted, but for a group of carriages standing before the Reggie Chiverses, where there was a dinner for the Duke, and the occasional figure of an elderly gentleman in heavy overcoat and muffler ascending a brownstone doorstep and disappearing into a gaslit hall. Thus, as Archer crossed Washington Square, he remarked that old Mr. Dulac was calling on his cousins the Dagonets, and turning down the corner of West 10th Street he saw Mr. Skipworth, of his own firm, obviously bound on a visit to the Miss Lannings. A little farther up Fifth Avenue, Beaufort appeared on his doorstep, darkly projected against a blaze of light, descended to his private brougham, and rolled away to a mysterious and probably unmentionable destination. It was not an opera night, and no one was giving a party, so that Beaufort's outing was undoubtedly of a clandestine nature. Archer connected it in his mind with a little house beyond Lexington Avenue in which beribboned window curtains and flower boxes had recently appeared, and before whose newly painted door the canary-colored brougham of Miss Fanny Ring was frequently seen to wait. Beyond the small and slippery pyramid which composed Mrs. Archer's world lay the almost unmapped quarter inhabited by artists, musicians, and people who wrote. These scattered fragments of humanity had never shown any desire to be amalgamated with the social structure. In spite of odd ways they were said to be, for the most part, quite respectable, but they preferred to keep to themselves. Medora Manson, in her prosperous days, had inaugurated a literary salon, but it had soon died out owing to the reluctance of the literary to frequent it. Others had made the same attempt, and there was a household of blinkers, an intense and voluble mother, and three blousy daughters who imitated her, where one met Edwin Booth and Patti and William Winter, and the new Shakespearean actor George Rignald, and some of the magazine editors and musical and literary critics. Mrs. Archer and her group felt a certain timidity concerning these persons. They were odd, they were uncertain, they had things one didn't know about in the background of their lives and minds. Literature and art were deeply respected in the Archer set, and Mrs. Archer was always at pains to tell her children how much more agreeable and cultivated society had been when it included such figures as Washington Irving, Fitz Greene Halleck, and the poet of the Culprit Fay. The most celebrated authors of that generation had been gentlemen. Perhaps the unknown persons who succeeded them had gentlemanly sentiments, but their origin, their appearance, their air, their intimacy with the stage and the opera, made any old New York criterion inapplicable to them. When I was a girl, Mrs. Archer used to say, we knew everybody between the Battery and Canal Street, and only the people one knew had carriages. It was perfectly easy to place anyone then. Now one can't tell, and I prefer not to try. Only old Catherine Mingott, with her absence of moral prejudices, and almost parvenu indifference to the subtler distinctions, might have bridged the abyss, But as he had never opened a book or looked at a picture, and cared for music, only because it reminded her of gala nights at the Italiens, in the days of her triumph at the Tuileries. Possibly Beaufort, who was her match in daring, would have succeeded in bringing about a fusion, but his grand house and silk-stockinged footmen were an obstacle to informal sociability. Moreover, he was as illiterate as old Mrs. Mingott, and considered fellows who wrote as the mere paid purveyors of rich men's pleasures, and no one rich enough to influence his opinion had ever questioned it. Newland Archer had been aware of these things ever since he could remember, and had accepted them as part of the structure of his universe. He knew that there were societies where painters and poets and novelists and men of science, and even great actors, were as sought after as dukes. He had often pictured to himself what it would have been to live in the intimacy of drawing rooms dominated by the talk of Merimee, whose editors a union connu was one of his inseparables, of Thackeray, Browning or William Morris. But such things were inconceivable in New York, and unsettling to think of. Archer knew most of the fellows who wrote, the musicians and the painters. He met them at the Century, or at the little musical and theatrical clubs that were beginning to come into existence. He enjoyed them there, and was bored with them at the Blenkers, where they were mingled with fervid and dowdy women who passed them about like captured curiosities. And even after his most exciting talks with Ned Winsett, he always came away with the feeling that if his world was small, so was theirs, and that the only way to enlarge either was to reach a stage of manners where they would naturally merge. He was reminded of this by trying to picture the society in which the Countess Olenska had lived and suffered, and also perhaps tasted mysterious joys. He remembered with what amusement as he had told him that her grandmother Mingott and the Wellands objected to her living in a Bohemian quarter given over to Eopel, who wrote. It was not the peril, but the poverty, that her family disliked. But that shade escaped her, and she supposed they considered literature compromising. She herself had no fears of it, and the books scattered about her drawing room, a part of the house in which books were usually supposed to be out of place, though chiefly works of fiction, had whetted Archer's interest with such new names as those of Paul Burgett, Heisman's, and the Gonkert brothers. Ruminating on these things as he approached her door, he was once more conscious of the curious way in which he reversed his values, and of the need of thinking himself into conditions incredibly different from any that he knew, if he were to be of use in her present difficulty. Nastasia opened the door, smiling mysteriously. On the bench in the hall lay a sable-lined overcoat, a folded opera hat of dull silk with a gold JB on the lining, and a white silk muffler. There was no mistaking the fact that these costly articles were the property of Julius Beaufort. Archer was angry. So angry that he came near scribbling a word on his card and going away. Then he remembered that in writing to Madame Olenska he had been kept by excess of discretion from saying that he wished to see her privately. He had therefore no one but himself to blame, if as he had opened her doors to other visitors, and he entered the drawing room with the dogged determination to make Beaufort feel himself in the way, and to outstay him. The banker stood leaning against the mantel shelf, which was draped with an old embroidery held in place by brass candelabra containing church candies of yellowish wax. He had thrust his chest out, supporting his shoulders against the mantel, and resting his weight on one large patent leather foot. As Archer entered, he was smiling, and looking down on his hostess, who sat on the sofa placed at right angles to the chimney. A table banked with flowers formed a screen behind it, and against the orchids and azaleas which the young man recognized as tributes from the Beaufort hothouses. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.